you've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Welcome back, Launch Street. I've missed you. Hey, I have a question for you. Do you know anyone that is maybe stuck in a rut or struggling to move forward? Send them this podcast. Seriously, let's give them the tools to go further faster. Don't be selfish. By the way, if you could see me now, you'd know I'm smiling. I'm being kind of silly, kind of serious. But really, share with those that need innovation in their lives. We just have such incredible guests week after week that provide insights and tools and pull back the curtains. I just want to share those incredible insights with the world, with those that need it. Now, speaking of need, what do your customers need? And how do you apply that customer-centric viewpoint to your internal processes so that it's infused in everything you do? That's one of the several questions that I ask Jeff Guthall on Inside Launch Street today. We have this fascinating conversation about the falsity of the net promoter scores and how to ask questions that actually get to the heart of your customers' minds and, well, their hearts. Jeff helps organizations build better products and executives build the culture that builds those better products. He is a co-author of the award-winning book, Lean UX, and the Harvard Business Review Press book, Sense and Respond. Jeff works as a coach, consultant, and keynote speaker, helping companies bridge the gap between business agility, digital transformation, product management, and human-centered design. Most recently, Jeff co-founded Sense and Respond Press, a publishing house for practical business books for busy executives. So yeah, he's a little busy, but not too busy to stop by Launch Street and give you some insights. It's go time.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining me today. Clearly, this is going to be a lively conversation.
I'm really looking forward to it, Tamara. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Yeah. So tell us, what was your first memory of being innovative?
That's a really great question. And no one's really asked me that before. As I think back to, I did a lot of interesting things as a kid. But I guess one of the more classic kid things that I did was I had a paper route, and it was a means to an end. I liked the money that I made from my paper route because it enabled me to do the things that I wanted to do. But I despised the paper route, doing the work itself. It was dirty and it was heavy, and there were bullies on my route that would harass me. As I was riding around. Yeah, it was kind of a traumatic period, but I did this on my BMX bike in the 80s, you know. And the thing that I remember is to me it was kind of an iterative process every week of how efficiently can I get, because the papers would come out in these kind of very flat format. I had to roll them up, put them in bags, stuff them into the bag on my bike, and then ride around and throw them into people's driveways, right? And so my whole goal was to get through this process as quickly as possible. And so every week I would try a different approach to formatting the papers into the bag and then getting the as many papers as I could into the bag on my bike, because that meant less trips back and forth to my house. And then looking for that optimal route that got me through that process as quickly as possible with the least possible amount of harassment and ultimately done so I can move on to the next thing in my day. And I iterated on this kind of week after week after week. I got pretty good at it, I think, at the end, really kind of knocking out a significant amount of time over the initial couple of attempts at making it happen.
So there are so many layers to what you just said. And I feel like that was all said from like a true entrepreneur innovator mindset of like, I love the money. I love where I can go. Not sure I love the grind here. What do we do about that? So I have to ask, did anybody pay attention to what you were doing? I'm just curious if your parents looked at that and were like, oh my gosh, look at what Jeff is doing. Like, check him out.
You know, the short answer is no. And I think it's because the measure of success here wasn't for anybody else other than me. The measure of success wasn't how quickly can you get this done or how efficiently can you get it done. The measure of success for the newspaper was just get it done.
Right.
It's kind of a binary thing. As long as it happened on the Saturday that the paper came out, then that was fine. And for my parents, their measure of success was me asking for money less often. So as long as that was happening, everyone was happy.
I feel like you just gave me a brilliant idea with my kids. I told you, I have two boys, they're 10 and 14. I think I'm going to go tell them, go get jobs. And the less you ask me for the money, the more I'll reward you in other ways. So I think you just gave me, as a parent, an idea. And, you know, I think your story of having that paper route and kind of how you thought about the different variables coming together actually really makes sense for what you do at Sense and Respond, which we'll get into in a second. So because I want to talk a little bit about that. One of the things that you do and one of the reasons we wanted to have you on the podcast is in your work, you help companies bridge the gaps between business agility, digital transformation, product management, and human-centered design. And I want to ask you a little bit about how you think about that and how you do it, because those are all, I think, really hot topics right now in business and oftentimes siloed in how people think about them.
That's exactly right. That's exactly the work that I do. So people think that those are four distinct activities, processes, ideas, whatever you want to call them, that exist in these silos and that you need all four of them to be successful and innovative today. But that there's no clear connection between all four of those. And what I do is I work with companies to show them that all those things stem from the same philosophy and are different activities that certainly require specialists, right? So you need a product manager and you need a designer and you need transformation specialists or leaders who understand innovation and transformation and people who are experts in digital and technology and software. But the root of the motivation and the impetus for these ideas is the same. And this is what I draw that connection for companies, and that the success of these activities is interdependent on them. And so I really work hard to break those silos and really kind of illustrate clearly at least these four pillars interacting in a cross-functional collaborative way that moving your business forward at the pace of business in the 21st century is not going to work as well as you'd hope.
So let me back up for 1 second and ask you, when you think about the philosophy that binds all of them, how would you describe that?
The ability that we have today to learn is unprecedented. The raw material of business in the 21st century is software. It's technology. The way that you grow and scale and innovate and compete on a global scale is through technology. The nature of modern technology is fundamentally different than it was even 10 years ago. It's you know, or certainly when I started my career 20 years ago, you know, when I started my career 20 years ago, software came in a box. You went and bought a box of software, right? You went to the store and you got a box of Windows
or a box of incredible memories of also having to upgrade by buying a new box.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That world is gone. Yeah. The technology of today is continuous. Right, which is great, right? The technology of today is continuous. It's always improving, it's always updating, it's always getting better. What that provides us is an unprecedented ability to learn quickly how well our ideas match the needs of our customers, the needs of our business, the market, etc. And if we can harness that understanding of the customer need, if we can build in the kinds of systems that allow us to deliver ideas to customers' hands quickly, and then install the kinds of systems, processes, and ultimately the ways of working that allows them to take what we learn from people using those bits of software and transforming that into actionable improvements, then we truly start to build innovative, continuously learning and improving businesses. And that's the core here for all of this that binds all of these ideas together.
So that was so helpful. Thank you. Because I was actually curious, how are you going to pull them together too? I'm like, how does that? I mean, I get it like intuitively, but it's interesting to hear how tangibly they come together. I want to go back to something you just said, and I might butcher how you said it because I was trying to listen and not kind of be distracted by taking notes. But you said that, you know, we can match our products and services to the customer needs faster than ever before, understand if they match. How do you think about doing that as a process? And I think also as a mindset.
Yeah. And so this is, to me, this is the key that it's the hinge around which all of these ideas turn. There's a fundamental difference in how we've been measuring success in business up until basically today. We still do it today, and how we need to change how we measure success. So for the last 100 years, we've been measuring success as output.
Yes, right.
It's how much stuff can we make? How quickly can we make it at the lowest possible cost and increase our profit margins? Now, when you're manufacturing physical goods, right, exactly. And all of our business practices are optimized for that, because that's the root, at the root of that is manufacturing. And that makes sense when you're making a physical thing. But if you're building a system and the technology and the businesses that are built on top of these technological systems are themselves systems, then how much stuff you make doesn't matter anymore. What we're really looking for is, how did we impact customer behavior, or what is the outcome of the things that we produce? So when we put something in customers' hands, what changes in their behavior? And if we can view that our customers are changing their behavior in a way that's more beneficial to them, that will inevitably reward our business. And to me, that's the key for all of this. And so if we can move our mindsets away from, well, we have to make features or apps or systems or new services, and instead think about, ultimately, if we make our customers successful, what will they be doing differently than they are today? And use that as a measure of success, these ideas, you're sort of forced to then build this learning culture that innovates and grows exponentially.
So as you were talking, I was thinking about, I have a healthcare client in the retail pharmacy world. And one of the challenges that we were talking about is giving their customers information to take action on based on their prescriptions, health, et cetera. And one of the questions I asked him was, well, with this new digital way of communicating, basically email, text messages, that kind of stuff, what are you actually looking for? And they said, well, we're looking for them to take an action, meaning click on the link, whatever. And I thought to myself, I feel like there's a piece missing. Like, where's the actual behavior? Yes, they clicked on something, but is that really the behavior? Is the behavior, they refilled their medication faster, they stayed on their medication more consistently. So what you're saying is just kind of tracking with what this experience I had the other day. I'd love to hear from you kind of how you think about, how you figure out what that behavior is and how you track that backwards. Did that question make sense? It was a little bit jumbled in my head.
No, absolutely. And it fits nicely into my way of thinking, because I teach this exact exercise to my clients as well. So the way you laid it out, that's exactly right. Those are the outcomes we're looking for. Ultimately, we'd like people to stay on their medicine, to take it more consistently, to be healthier, to reduce the costs of care, right? Those kinds of things, right? Those are the outcomes. And so when I work with my clients and we think about, okay, how do we decide what outcomes we care about? We do an exercise. I run them through an exercise where I say, look, at the top of the board, I want you to write down the what I call impact metrics. Impact metrics are high-level measures of business health, so things like sales, revenue, profit, customer satisfaction.
And things that you can really see very easily.
Yeah, and things that these folks generally measure, right? Every organization measures sales, profit, revenue, right? That kind of stuff. And so put those at the top of the board. Now, for each one of those things, I want you to write down leading indicators, right? So what are the leading indicators that drive profit? What are the leading indicators that drive revenue? So for example, for profit, it could be, well, we need to reduce the number of customer service calls. that we get, because the more of those that we get, the more expensive it is for us, and that hurts our profit margin. Great. And we go through that for all of these items. What ends up happening is that each one of those essentially they end up being post-it notes, right? Each one of those post-it notes below the impact level metrics is an outcome. It's a measure of customer behavior, because it's customers interacting or users interacting with our systems that drive the business. And so then we look at that and I say, look, now we've got this board full of post-it notes, there's 30, 40, or 50 of these on here. Strategically, what do we care about this year? Right? What's our focus strategically for this year? Are we looking to expand into a different country? Are we looking to build in a different market? Right? And then let's use that as a filter to focus on the customer behaviors that we care about right now, because we've got finite time, finite people, right? And then that is, it's a forcing function to really get them to, first of all, visualize the connection between customer behavior and the success of the business. And second of all, use their strategic approach for the year to filter and prioritize the work more effectively.
So if I hear you right, Jeff, what you're saying there isn't just the view that I actually had before, which I think is a little bit too myopic, which is what's the customer behavior I want them to take based on the product or service that I give them, that they purchase from me. What you're saying is what's the behavior based on, you know, our product and services, but what's our behavior we want them to take based on our strategic goal. So if our goal is growth, the behavior we want from them might be different than if our goal is return service. I don't know. I'm making it up, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is what I do with the people that I work with. I say everybody starts with the product, right? Because it's easy and it's tangible and you can think, right. And we know it and we've got it. I always start with the outcome. I always start with what is the measure of success. If you buy what I'm saying, the measure of success is not making the thing or delivering the service. It's changing customer behavior. Okay. And so what is it, the behavior change we're looking for? And then let's go learn what the most effective combination of features, value proposition, business model, price models, right? Go-to-market campaign, what the optimal combination of those things are that generate the outcomes that we're looking for.
I see. So, okay, this is so good. So I'm going to geek out for a second with you. I hope you'll geek out with me, because this is one of my favorite topics. It's something you said earlier quickly, but I want to go back to it. When you were talking about the customer service calls, that example, you had said, what are the leading indicators? And I think leading indicators are incredibly important in business, particularly in innovation, when you understand where you're trying to go. But I think we often confuse leading and lagging indicators and often get trapped in lagging. And I've done it myself. I know I'm guilty of this. When you think about real leading indicators to help you figure this stuff out, what we're just talking about, how do you figure out which ones are the leaders versus the laggers?
Yeah. So the first of all, the lagging indicators are always impact level metrics. So profit, revenue, sales, that kind of stuff. Those are always backwards looking metrics. But there are others, you know, and that get a little bit less clear, right? So retention is a leading indicator of revenue, at least, but it's also kind of lagging because you're waiting to see if people come back and do something. Let me tell you a story. This is the story I tell people I work with all the time. And it's forget what you do for a living today and put yourself in the shoes of someone who owns a mattress store, right? So your new job is I own a mattress store. What's your high level measure of success? What's your impact metric for your mattress store?
Number of mattresses sold.
Right. Number of mattresses sold, revenue, that kind of thing, right?
Sales.
Terrific. Now, right, exactly. Now, what are the behaviors that you could potentially observe in your store that would indicate that someone might buy a mattress from you?
Okay. Oh, this is so fun. Okay. I recently bought a mattress. This is exciting. I'm going to go back to my own experience and say that they lie down on the mattress to test it. Like they're actually more than just walking by it. They ask questions of the salesperson. particularly around delivery times or how that works. Those would be the two, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's again. Yeah, but that's exactly right. You foot traffic to the store. I lie down on a mattress. I lie down on two mattresses. I ask about removing my old mattress. I show up with my partner. All of those things are outcomes. They're customer behaviors that indicate that someone might buy a mattress from you. Those are leading indicators. They're the tactical things that your customers or users do with the system as you intended to do it. Now, the components of your store, the things that drive those behaviors, those are output. Those are the things that you create, right? So, for example, I ran this same exercise with a group of designers in Norway late last year, and they said we would put all the mattress information on the ceiling of the store. Because that would force people to, right?
To lie super down. Clever, right? Yeah, that's actually genius.
Yeah. And force them to lie down, and that way they're testing the mattress. Now, putting the mattress information on the ceiling is an output. It's a thing that is a feature. You can call it a feature, right? Yeah. It's a thing that you make. The outcome is people lie down on mattresses, right? And that's what we're looking for because we know that that may drive sales.
That is, first of all, brilliant. And I hope they and everybody else does that who's listening. And I also really like about what you were just saying, Jeff, is that it made me really think about for my own business, what are the indicators that someone is going to buy? And they're probably not like, the phone ringing, right? Sales activity, mm-hmm. kind of those traditional ones, but there are probably others. Well, there definitely are others number of times on the website, number of times, or if they've taken our IQE assessment, like those type of things are indicators that I probably need to look at more of. How do I drive those? Those are my information on the ceiling that I haven't been paying attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you and I have a similar business, and I'm looking for similar things like that. Like how many people come to my events? How many people come to see me more than once? How many people buy a book from me? How many people buy two of my books from me? Right. That's always a good indication that they might end up being customers in the future.
Do you think there's such a thing as looking at too many numbers and getting kind of bogged down in data overwhelm? How do you deal with that?
Yes. So the short answer is yes. And the slightly longer answer is I learned a ton from a book called Lean Analytics. The book's six and a half years old at this point, written by Alistair Kroll and Ben Yoskovitz. It's a brilliant book that really at length answers the question that you just asked me. But the short of it, I'll give you kind of my executive summary of it, is this. Is that the numbers that you measure should change your behavior. In other words, if you're measuring something, every day you're like, the number went up, the number went down, you kind of shrug your shoulders and don't do anything about it, that's something that's not adding any kind of meaningful data into the way that you're running your business. So only focus on the metrics that change how you and your team behave today. And so that's number one. And the other tip that I'll give you from that book, which I think is brilliant, is that you want to measure the things that you need to know right now. And in other words, those two are complementary tactics, because depending on the where in the product life cycle your product or service or organization is, you're going to want to measure different things. So, for example, if you're launching a brand new product, you probably want to measure acquisition metrics. Right? Can I get people to the product? Will they download it? Do they sign up? That kind of thing. If you've been in market for 5, 10, 15, 25, 40 years, whatever it is, right? You're looking at, how much longer can I stretch this particular service out? What's the lifetime value of my customers? How can I make that longer? Right? How can I make that more valuable? Right? So to the most important things is focus on things that change your behavior and use that filter to adjust what you're measuring as your product matures through its life cycle.
I want to just emphasize, Jeff, what you're saying about it changes as your business changes. And that's something I certainly learned the hard way, that the metrics aren't the same that you want to look at. And we get, I think I got a little stuck in like, this is what I've always measured. Now I got to take this measurement to the next level, but there was really nowhere else to go. It didn't tell me anything I needed. Because the business had changed. So, and it feels like this is a really good time to ask you about an article you wrote that made me smile and laugh out loud. And the title is NPS is a Waste of Time, Use These Metrics Instead. So now for those who don't know, Net Promoter Score is NPS, and it's a scale of, what is it, one to, remind me again what the, it's one
to
seven?
It's one to 10.
One to 10.
No, it's one to 10.
Yeah, one to 10, yeah. Sorry. Seven is the cutoff that people want. That's why I was stuck on seven. I can't tell you the number of conversations I've had about NPS and bases is another one that we used to use a lot, which was all theoretical. It used to drive me bonkers. But I would love to hear your perspective on that, because I just, like I said, I get a lot of requests from clients who go, hey, we're trying to be more innovative and understand stuff. Can you analyze our NPS scores and give us some feedback? Mm-hmm. And I'm always like, oh, did you do the NPS test already? Like, okay. So I'd love to hear, like, this is really about like why you're analyzing stuff. So tell me about this.
Yeah. So look, I'm not bashing NPS for the sake of bashing it. I'm not bashing it because it's trendy or it gets me likes and clicks on my articles. I genuinely believe that there's entirely too much focus on measuring Net Promoter Score, which is a proxy for customer satisfaction. There's a lot of reasons why Net Promoter Score is broken, and the article goes into it a little bit, and it links to other articles that really dig into the fact. The primary reason is that you're asking somebody at a random point in time to predict how they'll behave in the future, right? Mm. Will you tell your friends about this thing that you just experienced, right? And that is that's speculative, and people always do things in the future that they say they'll do it, but they don't actually end up doing it.
And so, can I just interject for one second, Jeff? What always blows my mind about that is, why wouldn't you ask a simple question of, have you recommended us to a friend? Because that's a better indicator of, have you actually done it?
Right. That's something that's actually happened.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, keep going. It just, as you were saying that, I was like, oh God, you know, if they just changed that question. Yeah. Okay. Keep going.
Yeah. And Netflix does that. Netflix will say, did someone recommend us to you?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they may even ask who, I don't know. But look, so there's a lot of reasons why NPS is broken, but customer satisfaction as a whole is something that organizations obsess about, and they should. Yeah. They should be creating products and services that create satisfied customers. However, the measure of success, in my opinion, should be far less focused on whether customers are telling you they are satisfied, and instead focus on customers showing you that they are satisfied.
Right.
Right. Every time I see NPS or customer satisfaction show up in some executive dashboard, my question is always the same. It's, what do your satisfied customers do?
Right.
Oh, well, they buy from us. Great. What else do? They tell their friends about our service. Yeah. That's terrific. What else do? Well, they buy different product lines from us and they write reviews online.
Yes, right.
Right, exactly. Stick around, right? They and so to me, those behaviors, and again, back to outcomes, right, are far more valuable as a measure of the success of your efforts than somebody saying, yeah, I'm satisfied.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
You know, and that to me, that's absolutely the key, and why I think NPS particularly is a measure of customer status broken, but customer satisfaction as a whole, I think, is obsessed over as a metric too much.
Yes.
Right. As a goal. Sure. Who doesn't want satisfied customers? Right. Everybody does.
Well, to your point, though, the question is, which is really a focus on a lot of your work, even in new product development and in business strategy, is what are they actually doing? And I think what you were just saying around that is really brilliant. Oh, they tell a friend, they share a link to our website, they put a review for us, they buy a book, they upgrade every time we come out with something new. Like there are behaviors that we can actually track versus would use. And that was actually my whole issue with focus groups in my entire 20 plus years of doing new product development, was if you put a group of people together and say, would you buy this? Based on this concept, the answer is almost always yes.
Sure.
Unless there's a hard no because it doesn't fit into their life. But then you find, of course, that you put it out into the world and they don't buy it. So we used to flip it and buy. We used to rent kiosks at the mall, you know, those kiosks in the middle of the aisles or the walkway, whatever they're called. And we used to try to hawk fake product just to see if we could get people to come over and buy it. There was nothing to buy, but we'd see if like we'd set it up like a real store. And man, I will tell you, that told us what worked and what didn't work way more, because that same product in a focus group was a resounding yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I always joke that focus groups are the F word of customer research.
Seriously, right? I agree.
Right. But what you did was you ran an experiment, right? You faked, you faked the product, and you got to see whether or not people actually changed their behavior. And that's the key to all of this. And if organizations, and here's the thing, right? The reason it seems so simple, it seems so obvious to me. I sometimes get this imposter syndrome when I'm working with a client, and I said, look, it's just, that's all it is. It's just, we just measure customer behavior. It just seems so clear. But the implications in the way that we run our businesses are significant when it comes to changing whether we manage to output or manage to outcomes. It actually impacts the entire business.
So let me ask you a question about this, because we've kind of gone down a path into kind of what's a little bit of a cultural thing with a company, or like around experimentation, which is ultimately a culture around learning and growing and kind of being open to those results on either side. How do you build a culture of learning where experimentation and growth and that fast-paced learning is actually part of the DNA?
The most effective way that I've seen this done, and the most successful way, is to change the incentive structure for people. This is a big deal. It is company-wide, but we have to start to think about what we reward people for and what we praise and celebrate in the organization as well. That's a big deal, because it changes performance management criteria, hiring criteria, promotion criteria, that kind of thing. So that's one, but it's a big deal. One of the other most effective things is to see that behavior modeled in the leadership of the organization. So there's nothing more, and I've seen this firsthand, there's nothing more impactful on a team when their leader or their boss's boss or the CEO stands up in front of the company and shows some humility.
Yes.
Says something to the effect of, I really thought this was the right way to go, and I know we went down this path, and what I've learned since then is that I was wrong, and here's how we're going to adjust course based on that learning. It's incredibly powerful for that behavior to be modeled, because if it's okay for the CEO to do it,
yeah,
or my boss to do it, then it's okay for me to do it. And that is one of the best ways to change the culture.
So I got two things for you here, though. One is a comment, one I want you to elaborate on. I was at an event speaking at the same time as a submarine commander. He's actually going to be on the podcast in a couple weeks. And David Marquette is his name, and nuclear submarine, and with the worst culture possible when he came on board. And one of the things he said was, you know, he would ask people, what does this button do? Or what is, you know, it was a new type of submarine for him. And the first time he said, I don't, when they said, I don't know, do you? The first time he actually admitted he didn't know, because as a commander, you're supposed to know everything, right? That changed the culture in the entire submarine, where people were willing to say, I don't know. And in that situation, you needed to know when someone didn't know, you know, like you needed to admit that, because there were some serious ramifications. But I think the same is true, and the same applies to business, where if we can't admit we don't know, people don't, and then we go down really bad paths because nobody wants to admit they don't know. And that's so much more powerful in a learning environment to say, I don't know, and then let's go figure it out, than to just say, oh yeah, we should all know this ahead of time. I wanna loop back and ask you a question about incentive, because I think that's a really powerful thing. So I don't want to go too fast past that without digging into it. Because I think if you look at great companies, they tend to focus on behaviors, not outcomes, right? Let's get the behaviors we want. And I'm curious how, like, or if you can give some tangible examples of how you incentivize for growth and learning, not just say, good job, buddy.
Yeah.
Not that that's bad. Not I'm not saying that's bad. I'm like, everybody likes recognition, but I like where you're headed with like real incentives.
Right. No, a hearty handshake is not going to do it.
Probably not.
Yeah. Look, I think we need to start to think about how, so for example, I would look for behaviors that where leaders and kind of middle management, not necessarily executive leaders, but leaders in the organization are framing work as problems to solve rather than a solution to implement. Right? To me, that's a behavior that encourages learning. So I would one of the things I would say is, how many of your initiatives started with problems rather than solutions? That becomes an interesting conversation, because that incentivizes the team to go learn what the best solution is.
Right.
I would look at things like, how many times did you, I would look for things like decision making based on evidence rather than on politics, gut feeling, or position in the company. Right? I told you, I'm the boss. You do it.
Yeah.
So we're looking for those kinds of behaviors. I think that I would look for situations where the team has discovered evidence that conflicts with the direction that they were given, and how that was handled. And really looking for, again, it doesn't mandate that the executive should change their mind, but at the very least, there should be an open conversation there. And if those kinds of activities are happening, it means that we are encouraging people to explore and to push the envelope, right? If we're looking for that innovation, they're never going to push the envelope if they're afraid of being wrong.
Yeah.
And so this is an opportunity for that as well.
One of my favorite things to do is to incentivize or reward people, I should say, when they speak up when it's against the grain. Because I think we get in, even with a lot of brilliant, diverse people in the room, we can get into kind of assumptive and group thinking. And when that one person in a group of eight raises their hand and says, I don't agree and here's why, I think that takes a lot of courage. And it helps us build it. Now, it's not a matter of them being right or wrong. Either way, it helps strengthen whatever it is we're doing by seeing that perspective. Or it gets us back on track. I mean, there's a lot of outcomes that can happen. But to me, those types of behaviors are those are things we want to incentivize, because that's what gets us to better results.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And like you said, that's a cultural thing. We've got to create the kind of environment that where people feel safe to do that, because otherwise they'll never do.
Yes. And that's why I think, kind of to what you were saying earlier, it's really important to think about that front side of it, not just the impact indicators, because that's, I think, where we get trapped in not being safe, because we're so busy looking at the end that we're not creating the culture that actually gets us to the place we want.
That's right.
One of the things that you talked about that I thought was kind of intriguing, and I kind of nodded my head a little bit, but I wanted to hear where you were going to take this. You were talking about how we can learn a lot from software development to help us think about how we approach all of our business challenges. Why does software development, or how that process tends to work, help the rest of us?
Yes, this is one of the biggest pushbacks I get is, I work with largely traditional large companies, right? So banks, telcos, insurance companies, that kind of thing. And every time I come up and say, software's great and software's changing the world, they say, that's awesome for Facebook. That's awesome for Amazon, but or for Netflix or whatever. But we are a bank. We are a 160-year-old newspaper. We're an insurance company. We can't work like that. And look, the reality is that they can't work at that pace yet, and they don't have that DNA yet. But they can draw inspiration from the technology leaders that we have in the market today, and start to see how to apply that continuous learning, continuous improvement mindset to the way that they work. One of the things that I say to my clients all the time, I say, look, we talk about learning quickly. Quickly is relative. If today it takes you a year to find out whether your product idea is good or bad, and you can cut that down to 6 months, that's a win.
Yeah.
Right. If you can get it down to 3 months, that's a win. And so the inspiration, again, it's the model is ship, sense, and respond. Put something in the market, sense how it changes customer behavior, and then respond based on what you learn. Right. Mm. There's no reason you can't apply that in a bank or an insurance company. The pace that learning loop will take will be slower. But nevertheless, you're building that humility back into the process where it doesn't currently exist.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I do a lot of keynoting for IT groups, IT leaders inside groups, inside companies. And one of the things they've said to me often at the end is, you know, we really struggled with Agile, not because it's not good, but because we took it too seriously, meaning we tried to follow the exact timing versus the philosophy and the principles behind it. And I mean, it's kind of what you're saying here really is, hey, like what's important is that process that you just laid out. What is going to change is the timing, who's involved, how you respond. And I think some people get, and me too, get a little bit trapped in like, that's how they did it. So that's how we do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the challenging part is that large organizations are seeing the world change around them and they want to stay relevant and stay successful. And so they're looking for the recipe.
Yeah.
Give me the recipe. Give me the 10 steps that I need.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And the reality is that there isn't one. The processes we have today, they're great, but they're starting points. They're not destinations. And so, like you said, like the people are going to be different in your organization than in the other. The pace, the cadences of these things are going to change. And you've got to be willing to adjust the recipes to make them work for you. And if you're dogmatic about it, it will break. Something will break and it won't work. That's the bottom line.
So before we have to close, which I can't even believe, where can people go to learn and connect more?
So look, I'm easy, super easy to find online, and that's by design. I have a website at jeffgotthealth.com. That's always a good place to go. I spend a lot of time on Twitter. My Twitter username is jboogie, which is a long story we don't have time for today. And then I do a lot of writing on Medium, and of course LinkedIn is great too. So just basically my website will point you in the right direction. But if you Google my name, you'll find me. Super easy to find.
Awesome. And we'll put those links in the show note. I just realized I said learn and connect more. It should have been learn more and connect. I just totally flipped those. But so it's kind of fun. I was laughing as I thought about it. I just really quickly, before I have my closing question for you, because your book is fantastic, Lean UX. What's kind of, if I buy it, just for us listeners out there, kind of what can I expect to get out of it? I just want to give them a little bit of a glimpse to it because I thought it was great.
Sure. So Lean UX is a tactical book for product development teams to help them integrate product design and kind of that customer-centric approach into their agile software development practices. So it's a way to build that cross-functional collaboration between designers, product managers, and software engineers so that they can ultimately build more customer-centric, successful, outcome-based products.
Awesome. We'll put a link to that in the show notes too. The last question I want to ask you is, what's your one piece of advice for those of us out there trying to kind of make that blend of digital and product and customer centric, all that stuff we said in the beginning?
I think that if you make sure that the customer is at the center of everything that you do. I know that sounds a bit generic, so I'll clarify that just a little bit. What I mean is that there's always a feedback loop built into everything that you do. You're always, you're never more than a few days away from some kind of reality check, because we like to get caught up in our thing and we love our ideas and we think it's awesome and everyone's going to love it. But if you're building in that regular reality check once a week, once every couple days, whatever it is, once every couple weeks, it really injects your work and your ideas and your thinking with reality. And it greatly enhances the chances of your idea being successful.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for coming by. I know I took a few to-dos for my business out of it. I'm sure the rest of the listeners did as well. So thank you.
My pleasure, Tamara. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.